Hello, I am Daniel Morden. I'm a storyteller for 3 years. I'm visiting fellow at the University of South Wales, George Ewart Evans Centre for Storytelling. During the course of my tenure at that place, I am going to be making podcasts, and this is one of them. I am very pleased to be sitting in the front room of Mr. Alan Moore, who has been warping my consciousness with crazy and fascinating and inspiring ideas and stories now for some 40 years. So thank you for having me, Alan.
You're very, very welcome, Daniel.
And I wanted to start with the question, what you perceive a story to be?
Well, that's a very brief but enormous question.
So it is.
I would say that on one level, story is absolutely everything. It is it's the way that humans do things. We turn everything into a story. We turn our own lives, our own memories into the narrative of us. Looked at in one way, our news programs, which are looking at this chaotic and relatively random explosion of events happening daily in the world, and are then extracting parts of it, which is inevitably making that into a narrative. Mm. So our news is a story. Mm. Our lives are a story. Mm-hmm. And given that everything is a story, then you would suspect that the writing of stories and the creation of stories, the telling of stories, since this has been with us since, the Old Stone Age? Mm-hmm. Then this must be perhaps quite important to our evolution as a species. Nature doesn't seem to do very much purely because it would look nice. It doesn't do much purely for decoration. There seems to be a purpose for everything. And if storytelling seems to be a natural human faculty, then I would suggest that that is probably because storytelling serves some very important function in the way that we build and continue the world and our lives in it. It's a thing that obviously has taken up the greater part of my life.
Yeah.
The creation of narratives, the different ways in which they can be applied, and it has, of course, led me to actually thinking where stories come from, and my notions of that have been evolving over the years. I remember when I first got into magic, when I was around 40, 25 years ago now, I initially came up with the concept of idea space, a kind of conceptual space, as a model for how our minds might work, that suggesting that rather than having ideas, we find them in some kind of communal landscape of the mind. This was mainly a thing that I arrived at after having what seemed to me to be a magical experience, and then realising that I was going to have to come up with some kind of rational explanation for the experience that didn't make me mad. So, yeah, idea space was my first draft of that, and I still believe that there may potentially be a lot in that as a model, that it might be a very useful model in which we could consider consciousness and see what it does when it has that model applied to it, perhaps. But my friend, the writer John Higgs, he was talking to me about the concept, and he said, yeah, you realise that's a theory of consciousness? And I hadn't, but I was quite pleased with the notion, I suppose, although if I'd thought that it was a theory of consciousness, I'd have probably taken a bit more time over it. But and then John said, yeah, you do realise it's the only one. And Yeah, I definitely hadn't intended that at all. But yes, I mean, this is suggesting that storytellers, that writers, that they are merely receiving, not merely, because it's a big and a difficult job, but they are retrieving concepts or ideas from somewhere else and then conveying them into the world. And that strikes me as very similar to what William Burroughs said about the word vine, where he said that basically you come up with a word that will kind of suggest the next word, which will kind of suggest the next word, and so on. And there is a lot to be said for that. Although it does kind of imply that writers and storytellers are a medium through which ideas have themselves.
Yeah, well, this is it. What appeals to me about it is because I tell traditional stories, so we aren't originators. And so your analogy is very appealing to me because there's a kind of humility in it. There's a sense that we are a kind of conduit rather than someone, people who have these genius ideas that change the world.
Yeah,
it's all because of us.
I mean, well, I remember that when I was doing a lot more forceful magical investigation back in the 1990s, and I remember that there was one experience where we were investigating the Kabbalah, and we were specifically investigating the solar sphere, Tiferet, which means beauty or harmony. And at one point during that, I had an insight regarding the pride of artists, where it seemed to me that an artist, a writer, whatever, is at best a window, but that the window can look at the beautiful golden rectangle that it is casting upon the floor and mistake itself for the source of the light. Whereas all that we can do is to try and keep our windows clean, and if we can, to perhaps adjust their angle or broaden their width, but we are not the light. Which actually, I've been doing a lot of reading recently. One of the projects that I'm hoping to get started on next month, well, I'm hoping to pick up again next month. This would be the opera that I started writing some years ago based upon Dr. D. And I abandoned it all after getting about a third of it written, a third of the libretto. And for all I knew, that might have been the end of the project. But I met up with a friend of ours, Howard Gray, who used to be in the band Apollo 440. Howard is massively interested in opera and in that Renaissance period. He sent me, or put me in touch with, a wonderful book called Performance. I've forgotten the author's name at the moment, but it's talking about the Renaissance idea of performance, which turned out to be pretty much what I had said just now, that the source of the performance was seen as being, well, in Renaissance terms, God, and that the artist or performer was the channel through which that energy would be directed to the audience. And yeah, it was a remarkable insight into how Renaissance thinking worked upon those matters. It was they saw storytelling and art as sacred. And although I'm not a Christian and I would not obviously subscribe to their ideas of what the ultimate force in the universe was, I can see common ground in that approach to art, because I believe actually we probably should treat art as if it was sacred.
Well, you won't hear me argue with that. There was a phase when you were doing a lot of performing, live performing. I don't know whether you still do, but I remember that period when you were out doing these sort of performances that were kind of rituals, the site-specific performances set on a certain date and so forth. And I remember you talking about opera as the kind of consummation of live performance because it features all the different art forms simultaneously, or many of the different art forms.
Well, yeah, I mean, originally, I mean, opera in the West was pretty much the invention of Claudio Monteverdi, who was an alchemist, and the ideas behind alchemy at that period, they were talking about, which was very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a bunch of superstitious idiots who were trying to turn lead into gold.
No.
It was more about transmuting the human identity and the human spirit, whatever, from a base material level to the golden level of Tiferet, the solar sphere that I just mentioned. So the alchemists, they were talking about the creation of an art form that they referred to as the language of the birds, which was a particularly dense and elaborate form of poetry by which they thought that they could perhaps best transmit alchemical ideas. This was probably based upon the legend of the Egyptian mythology relating to the god Thoth or Tehuti, the ibis-headed god of language and magic, who allegedly had created human language from the language of the birds, probably particularly from the ibis. The cry of an ibis does sound very human, actually. So Monteverdi created opera to include all of the other art and to transmit alchemical ideas, which is why most of the early operas, things like the Ring Cycle, you know, the Magic Flute, they are occult and alchemical in their design. And this was back when artists were working with an intense sense of purpose. In a sense, it doesn't matter whether their mystical and spiritual theories were right or not. They were filled with tremendous energy, a creative energy, that led them to come up with all of these wonderful things that have undeniably enriched human culture.
Even outside the art form of opera, the analogy stands with regard to alchemy. That's what I think any storyteller is trying to do, is trying to turn something base and ordinary, which is us in a room and words, into something transformational that can only happen with an audience. You're trying to turn it into something golden, something magical, which may or may not happen according to a whole variety of different
absolutely values. But you're dead right, and that is one of the uses of magic, one of the uses of storytelling. I can remember a specific personal example that back in about 1995, I was looking to do a second magical performance after the first one at the Broadland Theatre in 1994. We'd agreed with a Newcastle arts organisation called Locus Plus that we'd do something in Newcastle. They'd said that they'd find us a venue. We had, this is me, Tim Perkins and David Jay, who were my musical accomplices at the time. We'd kind of done a ritual basically asking what the subject matter of the thing should be about. This had provoked a lengthy but luminous ramble about our childhoods, which seemed to say, yeah, this should be about childhood and childhood experience. So it still hadn't got much of a focus, And also the people in Newcastle got back to us and said, look, we're ever so sorry, but we can't find... We'd ask if they could find us perhaps a disused school or something that would suit the childhood setting.
Yeah.
And they said, look, the only thing we can find, it's a really lovely building. It's this old Victorian magistrates' court that's kind of built upon... It's built actually on the site of Hadrian's Wall. And we looked at it, and it did. It's a wonderful place. So we thought, okay, well, I guess we'll be doing it there then. That was around the point where my mother died, which was quite a disruptive experience emotionally. Tend to get a lot of huge, useless emotions crashing around inside your head, nothing that you can do with them. While we were sorting through her things, we came across this sheet of what turned out to be bandage wrapping. Just a sheet of blue paper with a little stamp at the end which identified the contents as bandages. But on it, there were these dark carmine patterns and this sort of waxy yellow material. And we realised that what this was a birth call.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, it was the birth call of my Uncle Jack that had been kept by his mother, my grandmother, Clara, because back in the day, such things, if a child was born with a call, such things were valuable. I think in the opening pages of David Copperfield, it talks about how his call had been put up for sale. Apparently, it was also prized by sailors and people who were working at sea because it was apparently supposed to make you proof from drowning.
Yeah, that's, I heard that.
So I thought, this is a kind of wonderful ancestral artifact. If I can't get a poem out of this, then I really do want shooting. And I thought, and this would be a place to put all of those feelings about my mum, which inevitably is about my childhood, because that is the time when you're connected most closely with your mother. So we went up and we did this thing, the birth call, up at this Newcastle, this court in Newcastle on my birthday in 1995, on November the 18th. It was only afterwards that we found out, when we looked up the thing in David Copperfield, we found out that in that, the person who buys David Copperfield's birth call is not a sailor, because apparently this is the origin of the barrister's wig.
The wig.
That it was meant to denote wisdom.
Yeah.
So a call would be worn to denote wisdom, and this eventually became the barrister's wig. But so actually doing it in a court turned out to be completely appropriate. But that is one of the uses of storytelling and of magic, that things, energies that are rumbling around inside you and which can even harm you, it's a way of expressing them, which also is, it's revering the loved one, the object of the departed. It's making them immortal by turning them and the circumstances of their death into art.
Yeah.
Because that's what art's for. Art escapes time.
Yeah.
I believe, ultimately, that time is an illusion. I think I believe that along with Albert Einstein. But art is the thing, right since we came up with the idea back in the Stone Age, around the campfire, some shaman came up with art. And we have used that to escape time, that we can project ourselves beyond the limits of our lifetimes, if we've got a good enough story, a good enough picture, that these things potentially these ideas passing from mind to mind are kind of immortal, or at least as immortal as our species.
I'm thinking of that chapter in Voice in the Fire where there's two witches who are about to be executed. And I always thought it was you who appears to them and says, I'd like something. And they say, you're after our souls. And the character, anyway, says, no, I want the idea of you.
Actually, yeah, you're dead right. It was me, at least in my head. Although, in the actual record, they just say that this creature appears to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which they identify as the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah, Eleanor Shaw and Mary Phillips, I think. They were actually disputed in the way that, I mean, history is, of course, a fiction.
Yeah.
But things tend to slide in and out of fiction. Oh, this is definitely real. This definitely happened.
It's
hang on.
Isn't it?
No,
it
didn't.
Yeah.
Or did it? Eventually we'll come up with some construction of the past that seems to make sense. But in the case of Eleanor Shaw and Mary Phillips, it was for a long time, you'd hear people saying the two witches, they weren't real. They can't have been real because we didn't burn witches in England. Witches were hung in England, they weren't burnt. To which I would say, yeah, that is absolutely true, apart from the two that we burnt in Northampton. And people have said, oh, well, the account that was written of them, the very detailed account that was written perhaps 100 years later or something like that, that there's a name of a verger at All Saints that's mentioned. We can't find that name, so the whole story must have been made up. No, I've heard local historians lately, and gratifyingly, say that, no, those witches actually existed. Another point against it was that, and even if you had burnt the witches, you wouldn't have been doing it in 1705, because everybody else had finished burning witches by the end of the 17th century. We weren't burning them into the 18th, to which I would say again, yeah, apart from in Northampton. We were amongst the first to start persecuting Jews, I believe, amongst the last to stop persecuting witches. Obviously, in Northampton, we apparently really like persecution. I think you should give us credit for that, you know?
That takes me to another kind of myth-making. I wanted to talk about your most recent novel, Jerusalem. I remember when I saw you around about the time you wrote Voice of Fire, and you had some very funny line about Voice in the Fire was about Northampton. I've decided that was a bit too general, and now I'm going to write an enormous novel about three or four streets or something like that.
That was basically the origins of Jerusalem, at least in a jocular way. It was saying that, yeah, just writing a story that was set in Northamptonshire was far too cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
And that I should write about what I knew. Which was the few blocks that I grew up in, which was an area that was called the Boroughs.
Yeah.
And it was the oldest area in the town. It was the poorest area in the town. At one point, it had been the whole of the town, the Saxon town, and various things had contributed to the fact that the Boroughs had been reduced to the state that it was in when I was born down there, where it was still, although poor, it was a lovely place to grow up because the sense of community was marvellous, and also everything had happened there. At the end of my street, there was the railway station, Castle Station, so-called, because it had been built on the ruins of the castle. This was the same castle that... this was King John's castle, as mentioned in Shakespeare's play of that name. This was the castle where I think two of the Crusades had started. The West's first encounter with Islam, and we can see how well that went. It was also the place where I think the first poll tax was raised, which had kicked off the peasants' revolt. It was, I think, the place where the Western world's first parliament ever sat. It was the place where Thomas à Becket had been summoned by Henry II and escaped in the middle of the night when he realised what kind of fate was waiting for him, went away to France for 6 years, and then ruinously came back and got stabbed in the cathedral. Yet, in this place, almost everything, national history and local history, had their focus.
Mm.
Charlie Chaplin, as a seven-year-old boy, had performed at Vint's Palace of Varieties down on the corner of Gold Street. It was Gold Street that, I think, in one of the earliest persecutions of the Jews, Henry III, who basically, I think, owed them money and wanted to. And so, yeah, that's generally the thing.
Yeah, it is.
There's financial reasons behind all of this. And so,
other money.
So he'd start. I'm not saying that this history is not ignoble history, a lot of it, but it's important history.
Mm.
In Mayfair, that was where Oliver Cromwell had stayed overnight the night before the Battle of Naseby, which had decided the English Civil War.
Mm.
The Cow Meadow in Becket's Park, not technically in the boroughs, but it was the park that was nearest to the boroughs, so that's where they'd all go on a Sunday afternoon. But that, when it was called the Cow Meadow, that was where the final battle of the War of the Roses happened, and where we took Henry VI prisoner, and where Edward IV became the new king, and he was out riding in Northampton, riding through a place which I believe was called at the time the Witchwood, which he thought would have kind of given him a fair warning at least, but sort of he met this absolutely beautiful woman who just happened to be out there waiting for him, even though I'm not sure that he'd known himself that he was going that way. But she explained that her family members had been on the other side in the War of the Roses, and so she was there to plead for clemency, but which I think the king granted, but he was obviously very, very taken with her, and he married her in secret on May Day Eve, which is actually quite a big day in the witch's calendar. So you can imagine what everybody thought. This was Elizabeth Woodville, whose mother, Jaquetta St. Pol, had already been accused of witchcraft. I think we did have something of a reputation for witchcraft around here. And I think later, Richard III, another local boy, he said that we should more or less ignore the whole reign of Edward IV because it was under the sorcerer's control of the Woodville family. And I was talking about this to my mate Joe Brown, and I said, yeah, that's what Richard believed. I said, although he hadn't got any evidence for that. And Joe said, ah, but he'd got a hunch. So, yeah, all of this stuff has happened, and I thought, and this is in this one despised neighbourhood that has seen all of this stuff.
Mm.
The round church that was mentioned in Voice of the Fire, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that's in the boroughs.
Mm.
So I thought, yeah, I should like to actually write just about that part of Northampton, the part that I grew up in, which I think that will necessitate talking about my family history, which had got some fantastic and appalling stories connected to it. And I thought, and the history of the other people who lived in that neighbourhood, yet the famous ones, and the ones that everybody knew locally, who were, in their way, equally as massive or bigger figures.
Yeah.
There was a slave from Tennessee who was, He was not the first black person to set foot in the boroughs, but he would have been one of them. Apparently there was a Peter the Saracen who had been around in the reign of King John, who may have been black, because Saracen was a very broad word that could have meant almost anything that wasn't quite white.
Yeah.
But Henry George, who'd come over here, arrived here in 1897, he was a liberated slave. He'd got a brand on his shoulder. I really didn't know that they used to brand slaves. But he'd got a brand on his shoulder, and when I worked out the age that he died at, the slaves would have been liberated when he was 13.
Mm.
Which, when I was reconstructing the story, led me to have to think, so what age would you brand a child?
It's funny where the imagination takes you.
Yeah, it certainly is. So there was that story, which I thought, that needs telling.
Mm. Yeah.
The little that is known about him, I'll put that in and I'll reconstruct the rest according to what seems likely.
Yeah.
And some stuff I'll just make up because it deserves to be in there. And I was also, there were so many things that fed into this book. I was also thinking a great deal about a concept of time that had been with me for quite a while, but was only slowly coalescing into something. The first time I had thoughts along those lines would have probably been when I was a child, looking up at the pictures of these old men with mutton chop sideburns that were sort of photographs of them that had bleached out, that were hanging in frames in the kind of fairly dark living room down at St. Andrew's Road. Some of them were probably, I don't know, great uncles, a grandfather, people that I'd never met.
Mm.
And I remember looking at them and thinking, I wonder if they know, squinting into the light in a pub garden 50 years ago, I wonder if they know that they're dead. And then I thought, no, they probably don't, but they are, aren't they? Even though at that moment when the cameras captured them, they're not.
Mm.
And that led me to sort of think in a kind of childish way, and not as well articulated as this, I remember thinking, yeah, at some point there'll be people looking at pictures of me after I'm dead. And realising, in a sense, that they already were. Yeah, there would be people looking at pictures of me after I was dead. So, in a sense, they already were. The future was already there.
Mm.
And the past was still there, in a way.
Mm.
This kind of echoed throughout a lot of my work. I think it's the perspective of Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen.
It is in Watchmen.
There's a couple of those future shocks that I wrote for 2000 AD.
Way back.
That have got a similar approach to time.
Mm.
William Gull in From Hell with his visions of the future.
Mm.
So I was starting to come up with this concept that, all right, so if the future is, it already exists, then don't all of the physicists since Einstein suggest that we are living in a four-dimensional universe where, as I understand it, time is not the fourth dimension, but time is the way that we perceive the fourth dimension, because the fourth dimension, that's a spatial term.
Yeah.
So this matchbox, it has height, it has width, it has length, and then it also has duration, or at least as we see it.
Mm.
So I was putting these ideas together and thinking, yeah, so basically that would suggest that time is a solid, a four-dimensional solid, in which all of the moments between the Big Bang and the Big Crunch or whatever all exist coterminously, including all of those moments that make up our lives, during which we were conscious and alive. Even if we were asleep, we were still conscious of stuff. We were alive. Now, if this solid block of space-time, if that is eternal and unchanging, then so is everything in it, which would suggest that the way that our minds, our consciousness, moves through this solid space-time continuum, it would be a bit like, say, if you consider a length of film, old school film, where those individual cells, they're not moving.
No.
They are like that forever. But when the beam of the projector or our consciousness moves across them, then we have the illusion of movement, we have the illusion of motivation, we have the illusion of morality, we see Charlie Chaplin defeat the bully and get the girl and do his funny walk, whereas nothing's moving, nothing's changing, apart from our consciousness moving through it. The same is true of a book or a story. Yes. It's like the story of our lives. When we get to the end of the book, the book doesn't suddenly turn to dust or combust or something like that. It's still there. We can read it again.
Yeah.
All of the words that made up that story are there in the compressed volume, millimetres away from each other, even though they might be centuries apart in time, years apart, but they're all there in that one solid object. And I thought, in that case, then death, and birth for that matter, wouldn't mean the same thing, would they? It would be like, if you're talking about time as a physical dimension, then your birth and your death could be compared to the soles of your feet and the top of your head. Now, I am not much bothered by the fact that I don't exist at, say, 6'4" above the ground, because I'm perfectly happy in this 6'2" that I've got. If you apply that to time, it suggests that, to me anyway, that when we get to the end of our mortal lifespan, our consciousness would have nowhere to go except back to the beginning. And that would imply a recurrence, potentially infinite, our lives.
It's consoling.
Over and over again. And they would always seem as if it was the first time.
Yeah.
Because it did the first time. If you can even speak of a first time. Now, some people find that consoling. I remember when I mentioned it over a curry to the late Ian Banks. He said, "Oh, my God, that is the worst thing I have ever heard. That is horrible." And, yeah, because my thinking behind Jerusalem was that, yeah, the best moments of your life forever, that is surely paradise. The worst moments of your life forever, that is surely eternal hell and damnation.
Hell.
And that led me to think, yeah, so it's all here and now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Heaven, hell, they're all right here, right now.
Yeah.
And I found that much more appealing than the idea of being judged by some remote being that I may not approve of the morality of. So these were the thoughts that were going into Jerusalem, the thought that everything is eternal. I came across, halfway through Jerusalem, which is a very big book, halfway through I came across a quote by Einstein where he was writing to console the widow of a fellow physicist. And he said to her, I'm paraphrasing here, he said, look, for physicists like myself and your husband, death isn't really a major issue because we understand the persistent illusion of transience.
The persistent illusion of transience.
Yeah. That things are going away, that you can't get Spangles anymore, that television on a Saturday night is rubbish compared to what, you know, that everything's going, people that you loved, institutions that you loved, buildings that you loved, they've all been pulled down, they're all dead. No, they're fine. They're just back down the road.
Mm.
And life has only got one kind of direction of travel. So if you're in a car going along a street, a road, you might pass some really lovely houses.
Mm.
You go on for 100 yards, half a mile, you can't see them anymore.
Mm.
But you know that they're still there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of, and that if you could drive back that way, that they would still be there. Yeah, some people find this claustrophobic, but Nietzsche came up with a similar idea, although he hadn't got Einstein and his ideas to back. He was working upon the idea that if this was an infinite universe, then if it was a truly infinite universe, then yes, you would get this planet exactly repeated to the smallest detail an infinite number of times, because that's infinity for you. But Nietzsche said that he thought that this was the best and most scientific belief in an afterlife. He said that whether it's true or not, if you behaved as if it was true, you would have a better life.
Yeah.
He also said that whoever popularises this idea will be the most hated figure in human history.
I'm reminded of an Irish storyteller who said, the victors always write the history and the losers write the songs. And you've got an agenda as well, though. I mean, even though everything is still there, physically, if we went down to the boroughs that you remembered, the place where the boroughs are, where you grew up,
yeah,
a lot of it's gone now, isn't it?
All of it's gone.
Yeah.
They speeded it up after Jerusalem came out. It sort of, perhaps it is me being paranoid, but it, a lot of the empty barren sites that had been empty for 30 years that I was talking about in Jerusalem, they've put up unaffordable, new, affordable housing and sort of pulled down loads of it. Yeah, there's still some of the main buildings that are still there and probably will be there for a long time.
But it's
gone.
But it's in your book.
Exactly. It's
in your book.
There's a bit at the end, because I've done some clever literary stuff. I appear in the novel because it's talking about my family history.
Yeah.
Although I've disguised it because I wanted this to be a fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've changed the names to protect the guilty and sort of, I myself appear in the book as, I appear in drag as a very personable woman. An artist, she's not a writer, you see, I'm trying to throw everybody off the scent here.
Well, you're kind of giving it away now, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I suppose I have, haven't I? So yeah, I've got this artist called Alma Warren, who is working upon a series of paintings on the behalf of her brother. Because her brother, who is called Mick, the same as my brother is called Mick, had a strange experience when he was a child, which actually my brother did. He was very small. He would have perhaps been 5. Anyway, he'd been taken to the doctors because he'd got an inflamed throat. The doctor, who, looking back, probably was a bit resentful that his practice was in an area as shabby as the boroughs. And with this endless succession of women with their scruffy kids sort of coming in and out. And my mother had taken my brother to the doctors. The doctor had taken a look at him and said, this boy's got a sore throat, just give him cough sweets. Now, my mother, anything that a middle-class person, especially a doctor, said to her, was like holy writ. So she went out and dutifully got a packet of Cherry Menthol Tunes. And he was sitting on her lap. I was down there. It must have been during the school holidays. We were sitting in the back garden. That yard. It wasn't a garden. He was sitting on her lap. She gave him a Cherry Menthol Tune. Apparently, he hadn't got a sore throat. He'd got chronic tonsillitis, and his tonsils had swollen up to the point where there was a very, very narrow breathing hole left. So the last thing he wanted was a Cherry Menthol Tune. Yeah. So it got stuck in his throat, and he just stopped. His eyes glazed over. He wasn't breathing. We didn't know about the Heimlich manoeuvre in those days. My mother was shaking him by the ankles. She was slapping him on the back. She was reaching into his mouth to try and fish this thing out of his throat. Nothing worked. There were no cars in the neighbourhood. The only telephone was a call box along the end of the road. However, our next door neighbour had a vegetable delivery business and had got an old vegetable delivery lorry parked in, and he said, bring him round the front and I'll take you up to the hospital. So they drove up to the hospital, which was quite a long way. Even if they were absolutely flying, and given for the fact that there wouldn't have been so much traffic on the road then, it had to be 10 minutes before they got him to the hospital, fished the thing out of his throat, and he started breathing again, which we were all very grateful for. And once we'd got him back home, we didn't think much about it. Except in later life, I thought, well, hang on.
10 minutes.
You know, 10 minutes. I mean, it's brain death after, what, two?
Mm.
How did that happen? And doesn't that give me a wonderful space? So for that 10 minutes, he was, like, technically dead. So I bet I could get quite a lot into that 10 minutes, because I had needed something else other than this idea of an eternal recurrence, because the only way to convey that in a book would be to tell someone's life story and then tell it again, word for word, and again in the same book until the reader gets the idea. And although I have subjected my readership to quite a lot of things over the years, I would not do that. So I thought, all right, what this needs then is some kind of, I don't know, fifth dimensional level from which one can see all of what's going on in a fourth dimensional kind of world below.
Mm.
So I came up with this bizarre afterlife, a fourth dimensional afterlife, a place where you can exist if you don't want to plunge straight back into your life.
Mm.
And I kind of, the whole middle section of the book deals with this.
Mm.
And I've described it as a savage, hallucinating Enid Blyton. Because it's all about children. Because it's my brother's experience. He was a child at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, yeah, it'd be best if it was other children that were showing him around this kind of afterlife and revealing all the things that I want revealed to him. And that inevitably, it becomes a kind of Secret Seven, Famous Five kind of thing. But it's a very adult story being told. And yet it's got the atmosphere of a kid's gang story.
Mm.
And I thought, yeah, that'd be a good thing to sort of shove in the middle of your immensely literary novel.
Mm.
Children's stories, why not? It's and out of all of those things, Jerusalem emerged over 10 years.
So you got this motivation about telling a story that has been overlooked. So what did the community make of it? I mean, you've already described it as dense and immense.
Actually, one of the first people that I gave it to read was my brother Michael, who I don't think has ever read a literary novel in his life.
Mm.
He read it all through, including the Lucia Joyce chapter, which is not even in English.
What is it in if it's not in English?
It's in kind of James Joyce.
Oh, okay.
So only
Lucia Joyce's James Joyce's
daughter. Daughter, right. Who, she'd been abused. She'd been abused from a very early age. And when her brother announced that he was getting married, she started acting up. It was decided, I think, between her brother and her mother that the best place for Lucia would be some sort of mental institution. So this was, I mean, she was a brilliant dancer in the 1920s. Mm. People used to say that one day James Joyce would be remembered as Lucia's father.
Mm.
But she entered a series of psychiatric hospitals. She was dealt with, I think, kind of unsympathetically by Carl Jung.
Mm.
When she was in a institution in France when the Germans invaded, who had already said that they intended to get rid of the physically and intellectually weak,
mm-hmm.
which meant, yeah, we're going to sort of get rid of people in hospitals and stuff like that. James Joyce died while he was still trying frantically to get Lucia to safety in Switzerland with the rest of the family.
Yeah.
But he died before he could see whether that had been successful. It evidently was, because she was moved through various institutions throughout the world. And I think at one point she called at St. Andrew's Hospital on the Billing Road in town.
Right.
And I think she liked it there because she was there from 1953, something like that, 55, within a couple of years of me being born.
Yeah.
She was there, and she was there until her death in 1980. So all the time that I was at school, at the grammar school next door to St. Andrew's Hospital, she was there.
Mm.
And she's now buried up at Kingsthorpe Cemetery. A few graves down from a Mr. Finnegan. It's sort of... And I thought, that asylum, John Clare was there. Dusty Springfield. And Sir Malcolm Arnold. And J.K. Stephen, the misogynist poet who was a Ripper suspect at one point, he was there. And all of these people. And I thought, yeah, I've got to do a story about that one chapter, the Lucia Joyce chapter. But Mike read that through and he said, yeah, actually, after a while, I kind of forgot that it was different to English.
Yeah, I've had that experience with things like Ridley Walker.
Yeah, which was a great book.
Yeah.
Russell Hoban. Yeah.
Fantastic. I had that same experience. I kind of started thinking in the language in which it was written, and a bit like, you know, when you're really good at another language and you start forming thoughts in French or whatever the other language is.
I mean, like when I'd finished writing that chapter, I couldn't even think in English for a while. That was the point where I thought, yeah, I've broken my brain, haven't I? And if I carry on with the book now, I will be exhausted. So I took a 2-year break and did my beautiful but doomed underground magazine, Dodgem Logic, until I'd sufficiently recovered and could continue with the novel. But actually, the working class people who've read it, they, by and large, have loved it.
Oh, great.
And that is the most important thing.
Yeah,
because if I had written a book that the critics adored, but that the working people that it was about and for couldn't understand it or weren't interested in it, didn't find it sufficiently involving or exciting, then it would have been a massive failure. I mean, obviously, particularly around Northampton, where people... They like the idea that these streets that they'd barely noticed, that had become drab and over-familiar, so that you don't even see them anymore. They like to have their landscape reinvested with a kind of mythical energy.
Yeah.
So that they can feel like mythical beings in a mythical world.
Yeah, I one of the few things I can retain from my misspent degree is one of my lecturers saying the purpose of art is to make the stone stony again.
Yes.
In a small way, I'm trying to do that with my hometown, probably from your inspiration.
I think that's great. I think we should all do it.
Yeah, I do too.
We should write place.
Yeah.
And that involves, as I came to understand when I was doing my piece Unearthing,
yeah,
which was a biography of Steve Moore,
yeah,
who had lived in one place all of his life, who lived and died. He was born and died within about, the two spots were about 5 paces away from each other. And when I was writing his story, I realised, well, you've got to write the story of Shooter's Hill as well.
Mm.
Because somebody like that, they're obviously completely interwoven with the place that they existed in. Then I came to realise that, yeah, it's not just Steve, though, is it? It's everybody and everything. You can't write psychogeography without writing psychobiography and vice versa. That sort of a place is often the sum of the people who have passed through it or acted upon it. And a person is very often the sum of all of the places and situations that have acted upon them.
But it makes me think of a... Have you run across Lafcadio Hearn?
Yes, I have.
Yeah,
he did. He was a wonderful storyteller and a fantastic translator.
Yeah.
Steve Moore, who was a closet... Not even so much of a closet, but closet decadent.
Yeah.
He loved all the decadent writers, and he introduced me to loads of them, including Lafcadio Hearn. But yeah, sorry, what were you going to say?
Ah, that's all right. So there's a story by him, well, from him. It's a traditional story that he's retold. Maybe you ran across it. It's in the film that was made called Kwaidan, which is rather glorious, very slow.
Yes, I think I've seen quite... I think that Steve showed me that, I think.
Anyway, the plot is this. There's a blind storyteller, so he's a bard. He plays a stringed instrument. He's sitting on the veranda of the temple where he lives, and he hears a voice saying, I'm a samurai, and the family whom I serve have returned to this area to visit the site of a sea battle where so many of their ancestors died. And we would be honoured if you would come and sing the story of that sea battle to my master and his family. And Hoichi was the name of the bard. He agrees. So he lifts his hand, he's led off the veranda quite a way away till he can hear the hubbub of people around him, he can hear the rustle of clothes. And then everything settles, and he sings this story. And it's the story of the meeting of these two clans out at sea. And there's a tremendous sea battle, and the story says that even now, on the backs, on the shells of the crabs that live in that bay, you can still see the faces of the people who've died during the sea battle. So
that's a real thing, isn't it? Samurai crabs?
I'm not surprised.
It's a real thing. It's because that was perhaps the story that started
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But people who took out crabs that had got an accidental marking that looked a bit like a samurai face would throw them back.
Right.
And so consequently, the only crabs that were living to reproduce were the ones that looked more and more like samurai.
Humans.
That's
an interesting detail I didn't know before. Anyway, so they thank him, they lead him back to his veranda, and the next morning the priests in the temple see him, and the bard is looking very gaunt, and they say, "What's up?" And he's been told the night before by the family who he sang the story to, "Please, we don't want this feud to reignite, so don't tell anyone where you've been. Will you come back tomorrow?" and sing the story again to us? And he says, okay, I will, I'll be honoured. So the next morning, the priests say, you know, what's up with you? And he says, oh, nothing, nothing, nothing. I just didn't sleep very well. So he keeps going every night, led by this samurai, and singing this story. And each morning, the priests see him looking more emaciated. And so one night, they decide to watch him. Now, he's blind, right? So he's sitting alone on the veranda, and the priests who are watching him see him stand up and start talking. And they see him make his way off the veranda, and they follow him to the graveyard. And he's singing the story of the sea battle to the ghosts.
To the ghosts.
Of the people who've died.
Who died in the battle.
So the priests interrupt this, and they drag him back, and they say, you can't do this, because the story you're telling is giving the ghost strength.
And taking it from the storyteller?
He's draining himself, but more importantly, he's bringing these beings, these people who died...
Back to material form.
Back to material form.
Of course, is any storyteller.
Well, this is it. And it leads me to wonder often about story in its widest sense, about the danger that comes with being a storyteller as well.
That's true, although there are the benefits. I mean, like, before I got off on my huge ramble about Jerusalem, what I was basically trying to express was that, yeah, in the book, you've got this character called Mick Warren, who's semi-famous artist sister, Alma Warren. After hearing his muddled account of a sudden memory of what had happened to him when he had that choking incident when he was a child, and this has recurred when, in his later job, he knocks himself unconscious after getting a face full of caustic chemicals and running around blinded and screaming, which actually did happen to Mike. And he runs into a metal bar, knocks himself out. When he comes round, he has a memory of what had happened when he was a small child.
Right.
So he is worried that he's going mad, tells his sister about all of this. So she says, yeah, the only way to sort this out is for me to do a whole series of paintings based upon your vision, and that will make everything all right. And so that is what happens in Jerusalem. And she does do the entire enormous book is bracketed by my brother arrives at her exhibition in the prelude. And then in the afterlude, you resume with his story of him at Alma's exhibition. But there's a bit of dialogue where, after the exhibition's concluded, he's saying to her, so have you saved the boroughs then, in some way, doing all this stuff? Will they come and rebuild it now or something? And she says, no, because that would be horrible. That would be like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but with buildings instead of people. No, I've saved it in a different sense.
Yeah.
I've saved it in a ship in a bottle sense.
Yeah.
And he says, and that's the only way you can save things. Yeah. All the people will die. All the buildings will be pulled down eventually. Yeah. All the places that we love and the people that we love, they will go.
Yeah.
But through the power of art, through the power of story, you can preserve them, not just the buildings and how they looked, but the precise fugitive impressions of atmosphere, the fleeting kind of quality of the light, all of these things that are gone in an instant. With prose, you can capture all of them and how people felt about these things.
Yeah.
It's much better than a kind of a freeze-dried, preserved, physical state of the thing.
It's the essence of it, isn't it?
The essence, and that's where we live.
Yeah.
I believe we live in the essence, or we can do,
more
than we live in the actual bricks and mortar.
Yeah, so that is certainly the compensatory element of being a storyteller. I just look around, particularly at the moment, and see the damage that a story can have.
Yeah, well, this is, I made a distinction quite early. I forget where I made it now. I think it was in Voice of the Fire. I was talking about, there's a bit where I'm talking about in the final chapter about actually writing the novel.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
And there's a bit where I say, yeah, I've got to actually faithfully record the events that happen. I said, because this is a story, it's not a lie. That can be similar.
Mm.
Because, of course, a story is a lie, but it's a lie that is understood by its public as a lie. So it's not a lie. It's something different. Whereas disinformation, lying, this is the stuff that is genuinely corrosive. It's fictions that are passing themselves off as truth.
And then we've got this word myth, which, first of all, it seemed to mean the other way of perceiving the world, the mythos and the logos. You know, the logos is the logical way of perceiving the world. The mythos is the dream that captures the essence of what took place. But now a myth has come to be understood as a lie. That's not true. It's a myth.
That is because of a lack of understanding of what a myth is. I mean, I do remember the divine actress Louise Brooks, as an older lady, apparently she got a letter from the cartoonist Guido Crepax, who had fetishised Louise Brooks in a lot of his illustrations, which was a tiny bit morbid for my taste, I've got to admit. But anyway, he'd written her a letter, and the reply said, "Dear Mr. Crepax, when I arose from my bed this morning and put on my slippers and dressing gown and creaked down the stairs to pick up the mail, I was intrigued to get your letter because after decades of being told that I am legendary, I now find that I am mythical." And I could see her point. But I can also see yours. A myth is not a lie.
Mm.
A myth is not even a fiction. It's not even a story. It's something more important.
Mm.
A myth is a story that has transcended what a story ought to be and has become something that has almost universal human application and thus becomes, in my experience, speaking as a practicing magician, it becomes as real as anybody is. Alan Turing and the Turing test.
Mm.
I think that Alan Turing, he was having a bit of a laugh with that, because what he was saying was, well, if we couldn't tell, if you've got like two slots in the wall and one of them's producing material from a human being and the other one from a machine, if we couldn't tell one from the other, if a human recipient couldn't tell one from the other, we would have to allow, what, that the machine was conscious? No, you wouldn't have to allow that. You would have to allow that the machine was at least as good at appearing conscious as a human is. Because we can't even prove that another human is conscious.
Mm.
So what Turing was saying was that sort of, that is the best that it will ever be.
Mm.
That is the best that we can ever say. Well, it appears to be conscious. So I will treat it as conscious. Now, in my activities as a magician, I treat these stories that have transcended story to become myths. If I encounter one of them, like, say, the myth of Hermes, it seems only polite to treat it as if it were an independent being.
Mm.
Because then it might deign to talk to you. I mean, certainly, if someone came up to me and did not allow that I was an independent, really existing being, I wouldn't be inclined to talk to them.
Mm.
This is where, it's where language becomes alive. It's like in myth, which is a certain form of story, a certain condition of story. But in myth, that's where you get a sense of, yeah, this language is alive, and these beings, these stories, what we were saying about Burroughs and the word vine, these are an inevitable consequence of language. These have arisen out of language, these entities, and they have a reality. It's not the same as our reality, which is a material one, or at least the material part of it is material. We also have another reality, which is our internal reality, which is not material. But, I mean, with the plaques on the wall behind you there, the boards, what those are, John Dee's Enochian magic system, and there are tiny little squiggles on, there's lots of symbols on there, but there are tiny little squiggles that are unfamiliar. This is the Enochian language that he divined from, this is what the angels showed him, because it was their language, and he could communicate with them using this language. Now, in a sense, the Enochian language, it's like, any entity's name that can be spelled in that language is some sort of real existing entity. The language is alive. Or at least that is the understanding of it. And everything else, all of the complexities of the Enochian system, they emerge from the language. I think that something is true of more conventional myths and gods. Crowley, I've quoted Crowley as referring to magic as a disease of language. He was actually stealing, I believe, that Tolkien had actually said something. He talked about mythology as a disease of language, which I find a very compelling point of view, that this stuff will inevitably emerge out of language. Gods will emerge. And there will probably be a god of language amongst them. It gives a different relationship with this material language that I've worked with all my life. Since becoming a magician, it is a much more active relationship with letters and words and sentences.
It takes me back to the conversation I was having with you earlier on about performance. Say, Odysseus's dog. So Odysseus finally gets back home after after leaving 19 years before. Nobody recognises him. He's a beggar. Except the dog. The dog recognises him. This scrawny old mutt sitting on a dunghill, lifts its head, sees this beggar and knows, bang, he's back. And in that moment, the dog dies. And when I tell that, it can be very touching. Now, the dog probably never existed. Odysseus probably never existed.
It's the idea of a dog.
Somehow, that moment with an audience, people are moved. On a good night, people are moved.
I am not at all surprised.
But I find it extraordinary that this pattern of words has resulted in this emotion, in changing the mood of the room.
Another not entirely shaggy dog story. I remember when I was writing, they asked me to write the last two issues of Superman before a new artist took over and changed the entire continuity. So I was writing a finale for the Superman that had existed since 1939 and the one that I'd read as a child. And I put it together with a lot of care, and there was a bit in there where I wrote a sequence involving Superman's dog, Crypto, who, because I thought, the new artist says that he's going to get rid of all of the silly things about Superman's continuity. However, I believe that the silly things about Superman's continuity are absolutely essential to it, and so I'm going to give Crypto the best send off that anybody. And I wrote the scene and I thought, actually, I'm filling up. I thought, I mean, this is a character that I don't care about particularly, but for the purposes of this story, I've set out to care about it and to make the and I thought, I'm actually choking up here. I thought, that's really great, because I know from past experience, if I'm crying, then that is going to be the point when all of the audience cry.
Yeah.
it's somehow strange that the emotion that the artist is feeling when they create the work, the Chinese brush painters who would spend a whole day kind of preparing their brushes and grinding their pigment, and then if they were setting out to do a picture of a wild boar, they would be meditating, they would be getting into the state of mind, and then the actual picture would be done in one line, probably in a matter of seconds. But they would say, yeah, but I have to be excited when I paint the line, because otherwise, how could I expect the audience to be excited when they look at it?
Yeah.
And I thought, that is a great thing to internalise as a writer.
Yeah.
Don't write something that you think people would understand that this is funny.
Yeah.
Because it's not funny, is it? It's a show of funniness that isn't in itself actually funny.
Oh, blimey.
Unless you're laughing yourself, other people aren't going to laugh.
Yeah, there's a lot of stand-ups who I sit and think, you just think this is clever. You don't think this is funny.
I suppose I have been rather spoilt. I know some really brilliant stand-ups.
You do.
Stuart Lee.
Yeah, people
like that. Now, they're funny.
Yeah,
Robin Ince, Josie Long,
you know.
But it's an interesting process because, so you feel an emotion, and I'm convinced, all right, I put that emotion down in words as part of a story. Now, I'm convinced, and this may be completely wrong, but I'm convinced that I could have written those same words, and if I hadn't had that emotional experience backing them up, it wouldn't have worked. But somehow, because there is that emotional charge in those words, then it will survive the typing process, the wiring it to somebody else. It will go to the artist who will decipher the panel descriptions. It will go to the letterer. It will then go through a printing process. Then, and only then, will it get to the reader. But that emotional message will somehow be intact.
I find it endlessly mysterious that people who would struggle to weep over the death of somebody they knew will weep over the death of a dog that never existed.
That never existed. I find this with myself, that obviously I do weep over real people who are close to me, but I don't do it easily. I shed very few tears. I felt incredible amounts of stuff. I shed very few actual tears over my mother's death. There were some tears, but there was no helpless crying. It was all being dealt with internally. However, a fictional dog, a fictional character that I know I invented myself a few hours before or whatever, it will choke me up. And I suspect that this is true of all of us. That there's something closer to the essence than any real person ever can be. Now, I could probably write something about my mother that would reduce me to tears. I could probably do that quite easily. But it has to be, perhaps it has to be put into words. Perhaps we have to put a thing into words before we can process it at all.
But there's these descriptions, definitions of a spell as a pattern of words that transforms reality. And so, in a sense, a story is a spell.
Yes.
A poem is a spell. Oh, well, spells are poems.
Literally, yeah.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, I mean, but this, a grimoire, that's a grammar. The connections, the same language exists between poetry and magic. Invocation, evocation. The idea of using a spell to cast a glamour over something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's easily understood. That happens in the press when they're talking about celebrities. They create a glamour, and they place it over people. It's like ancient shamans, when they went on their magical internal journeys, they would often expect to receive some magical power as a result of these expeditions. And that might be flying or changing into an animal or poetry. And that took me back a bit when I first read it. I thought, what, so they're saying that poetry is a magical power like changing into an animal or flying? And I thought, actually, I'm betting that the only way that they could fly and change into animals was with a kind of poetry. I bet that it was an essential magical power. Yeah, that is something that I still believe intensely. That so, when people talk about the Aboriginal song lines, it took me a while to realise, yeah, of course, it's a sacred thing, and it is a song. It's also what you have to do before you've got the concept of maps. That the only way to navigate, say, between, you know, one place in Britain and another place that's, you know, a couple of hundred miles away, is with some kind of mnemonic whereby you'll be able to remember the directions. So I think we realised early on that if things rhyme,
yeah, then that's one
and have a rhythm,
yeah,
we can remember them much more easily. So before you went on your long journey, you'd probably learn a song. Go by the lightning-blasted tree and then you will in Watford be.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It wouldn't have been called Watford back in the ancient Stone Age, of course, but you get the general idea.
I get the gist. Brilliant. Well, I'm approaching the end of my time with you. Thank you for devoting so much of the afternoon to this conversation.
It's been my pleasure, Daniel. It's been a very, very lively conversation and, yeah, we'll have another one sometime.